Planning this morning to finish up our study of Ecclesiastes 9, looking at the last section, and that is verses 11 to 18. Ecclesiastes 9, 11 to 18. Yes, but. How do you feel when in a conversation, as you are getting into something perhaps a little sensitive and you express your viewpoint, the other person responds by saying, yes, but? That is frustrating, because often when people say that, it seems like they are not actually listening to your point. They are acknowledging it, perhaps superficially, and trying to move on quickly to their rebuttal, to what they want to say, not really giving careful thought and processing what you have just shared. And so people that deal in communication, they encourage you not to talk that way, but actually encourage a yes and approach. And what they mean by that is when somebody makes a comment, when somebody shares a viewpoint, you want to make a genuine effort to demonstrate appreciation for whatever they're sharing. You want to look for ways to elaborate on it, to perhaps incorporate it into your perspective somehow, to acknowledge the strengths of whatever they're saying. That's going to end up, hopefully, as you defer judgment and don't immediately react, hopefully it will have a way of reducing conflict and encouraging more of a spirit of collaboration. And it's not that you can never rebut in any way or say anything contradictory, but at least your viewpoint and your rebuttal is not your immediate reaction, and you're trying to present it in the context of appreciation for what has been said and genuinely taking it into consideration and looking at the matter from different angles. Well, I think that is generally a wise approach to communication. We ought to be quick to hear and not so quick to talk. We really ought to make an effort to understand other people before immediately inserting our own perspective. But the reality is that when you read the Bible, it is actually filled with those kinds of yes, but, or counterpoint sort of statements. And sometimes the counterpoint actually is made in such a direct way as to argue that the first point was wrong. I think of what Jesus did throughout the Sermon on the Mount when he would bring up a perspective of the Jews about the law, and he would say, "You have heard that it was said." And right away he says, "But I say to you," and actually you are wrong. There is a place in Scripture for that kind of rebuttal, depending on what is being said. Other times, it is not that the first idea is wrong, but that we're dealing with a complex issue where there is inherent and inescapable tension. And the answer isn't somehow in the middle, somehow melding the two viewpoints. The answer is actually incorporating both at the same time, even when you're a little bit frustrated and you have to live with loose ends and not everything gets resolved to your satisfaction. Both sides, in some cases, have to be upheld 100% and sometimes with equal weight in the discussion. Because leaning to one side to the neglect of the other side is sure to get you into trouble. It's sure to give you a warped, a twisted, an inaccurate perception. And this book of Ecclesiastes is very much like that. It is filled with counterpoint kinds of statements, where you encounter one truth and you think you've got it, and you're beginning to settle down, like, "I've sort of figured this out," and the next verse, like, you get slapped upside the head with totally opposite emphasis. It's like, how can all of this be true at one and the same time? In particular, you have a number of passages where Solomon is grieving over the frustrations and the burdens of earthly life. And of course, his purpose is that we would not idolize the material world. And yet, just as you are tempted to give in to despair, he comes back with a very positive statement that says, nevertheless, God has given you these blessings to enjoy, and he wants you to enter fully into the experience of them for his glory. And you find yourself a little bit confused, perhaps, trying to integrate all of this. There is this constant back and forth between the crushing problems of life, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the legitimate pleasures of life. And what I'm saying is that both sides are actually crucial to keep in our minds intention as a part of a biblical worldview. Well, we have been in chapter 9 for a few weeks here, and for the last couple of messages, we have been looking at some of the pleasures of life that God has given us to enjoy. And if you look back at verses 7 to 10, he speaks there about enjoying our food and our drink. He talks even about our garments and the celebration that of life that we can communicate through our garments. We have said a lot about the blessing of marriage and companionship. And then in verse 10, the blessing of work and the importance of being diligent and how that is a part of entering fully into the life God designs for us on earth. What next? Well, you're going to get jerked around further as you come to our passage today. Literally, verse 11 reads something like this. You see in your Bible there, again, I saw under the sun. Literally, it would be, I turned around and saw. In other words, he's been looking at one thing and had made some statements about enjoyment, and now he just sort of whiplash turns around and starts to deal with a different perspective and almost an opposite topic here. This is actually one of those yet but constructions. Without diminishing anything that's been said about enjoying life, he's going to come back with a counterpoint that's actually going to move in a different direction here. And you'll see that as I read the text. Go ahead and follow along as I read verses 11 to 18. I turned around and saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. For man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city, yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. Hopefully you picked up there a series of contrasts that establish these counterpoints. And the title of the message this morning is Counterpoints of Life. Counterpoints of Life. And I say counterpoints plural because there are two major ones and some other secondary ones along the way. And here is the first counterpoint. It is in contrast to all the positive things about life that we were talking about the last few weeks. And that is verses 11 to 12. That life's circumstances are uncertain. Lest you get too comfortable enjoying your food, enjoying your wife, enjoying your clothes, enjoying your work, lest you settle down too much and assume that after all, God's blessed me with these things. He wants me to enjoy them. Everything is just going to be even or on the up and up and always improving and always enjoying this unbroken experience of delight in these blessings of God. Bright sky to look forward to. Everything's hunky-dory. He comes back with a counterpoint and says, actually, not really. Life's circumstances, though they are blessed many times and enjoyable, life circumstances are uncertain. And to develop that thought, first of all, in verse 11, he teaches us that our abilities cannot guarantee good circumstances. Our abilities, our talents, our capacities for improving life, for protecting life, for getting ahead in life, for as desirable as those might be and as profitable as they may end up being and producing good outcomes, they're not guarantees. Now, he had already talked in this very chapter about how life is often unfair and how the same kinds of things happen to all kinds of different people, specifically whether they are righteous or wicked. People are going to end up suffering and ultimately die. So review with me at the beginning of the chapter. He said in verse 1, "But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner, and he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to them all." He had focused there on the unfairness or the inequities of life. It's not what you would expect, because the same kinds of evil or bad or suffering sorts of circumstances are experienced by people irrespective of their morality, right? Righteous, wicked, fool, wise. Irrespective of their spirituality and their relationship with God, he had talked about people sacrificing or swearing an oath and being in covenant with God and this sort of thing. It doesn't matter. Despite those kinds of very important foundational differences that speak to whether people have a walk with God to start with and speak of whether their life pleases God through their divinely enabled obedience, it doesn't matter. The same kinds of events happen to them all. And that was frustrating enough, but now he's not talking so much about issues of morality and spirituality. He's talking more about your abilities. Some of them are inherent. You maybe are born with certain strengths. And then you can also develop those through practice, through study, through experience. Whether it is natural or whether it is developed, you're looking here at abilities. And it is true that in general, if you have certain abilities, you'll be able to be successful in certain realms of life. They tend toward success and positive outcomes, but the point is, you cannot rely on that to be a guarantee. And he gives you some specifics here. First of all, let's talk about those who have a lot of physical ability. And he says, here's one of the things that I observe. The race is not to the swift. You can be a really fast runner, and yet any number of things could happen to trip you up. You could break a leg or pull a muscle, and that's the end of it. All of your practice, all of your past victories, all of your experience may not end up really helping you get ahead. Anything could happen, and you could lose the race. It is not necessarily to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Again, you could have all kinds of experience and all kinds of weaponry and all kinds of numbers in your army and all kinds of physical power, and yet the smallest thing could throw off your strategy, or the enemy could find some area of weakness that he capitalizes on, and everything just comes crashing down. Your physical abilities are not a guarantee of a good outcome. Somebody says, well, I give myself to the life of the mind, and surely as I as I think deeply, as I study, as I analyze, as I plan, as I strategize, surely I will be able to find a way to accomplish my goals in life. He says, well, your mental abilities won't necessarily do it either. Because he says he also observed, nor bread to the wise. You could have very wise people who for various reasons aren't able to implement their wonderful plans and are starving. Nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. Surely people who have a sharp mind, who have life experience, who have a wit, would find some way to gain advantage in their relationships where people like them and they're receiving favor and they get ahead in their endeavors. Maybe so, but maybe not. Your abilities are not a guarantee of positive outcomes. And I'm sure that you can look back on your own life and give all kinds of embarrassing illustrations of where what you thought was an area of strength, you actually fell flat on your face and you failed miserably. But lest we embarrass anybody here, I will talk about people that are in the news. Maybe you remember some of the great upsets of the Olympics in 2016. One of them was by the Williams sisters, who were ranked number one seed going into Rio and had just won the 14th time, for the 14th time, the Grand Slam championship title in Wimbledon, just like a couple weeks before, I think it was. And yet, very early on, they lost, and they lost opportunity to advance, and that was the end of it. News source says that it was their first defeat in 16 Olympic matches together, that they had won the gold in 2000, 2008, 2012, and Serena ended up saying, "We played terrible," and it showed in the results. And that wasn't all, because she herself in the singles tournament, also highly favored, ended up losing to Elena Svitolina of Ukraine, maybe because of a shoulder injury, and it said that she was close to tears as she walked off the court. A lot of people disappointed, and there were other stories like that. The race is not necessarily to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But here's the other way of saying it. Time and chance happen to them all. We need to take a moment to interpret that word chance, because that translation could be misleading. In our way of speaking, chance has to do with something random, or in this case, bad luck, or you might say fate or something like that, as though these circumstances are outside of God's control. We know they're outside of our control, but the word chance makes it sound like it's even outside of God's control, that this just kind of happened and God couldn't do much about it. He maybe wasn't even expecting it to take place. That is not what this word means in Hebrew. It's a word that basically means an event, a circumstance, something that happens or takes place. And sometimes it refers to a good event, sometimes to a bad event. The point is that it is an event viewed from a human perspective. Something that comes upon you is the idea. Something that happens, something that you cannot produce, something that you cannot anticipate, something that you cannot expect. It's just something that happens. And all kinds of painful, unexpected, rough, uncomfortable happenings take place no matter what your capacities, your abilities are. And his point is, look, there is no formula that is sure to get you success in every area of life. Life in a fallen world just has too many variables involved for you and I to be able to fit everything into a neat box that is based upon what we perceive to be our strengths. It's just not going to happen. And verse 12, he goes on to say that bad circumstances, not only can things happen to you that undercut your strengths, but actually they might happen to you very suddenly. And that's the point of verse 12. Particularly with this illustration, man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared in an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. If you are a fisherman or a hunter, you especially appreciate that image. And you may find it exciting. You may find it thrilling and satisfying to, after a period of planning where you camouflage yourself and you hide your efforts, you disguise your methods, you are able finally to catch your prey by surprise. They are totally blindsided, and you are thrilled that your plan has worked. There is no warning. The animal has been trapped. He has been captured, and he will soon be killed. Well, now that you have that image in mind, and maybe you do enjoy hunting and so forth, the author intends for you to picture yourself not like a victorious hunter, but to picture yourself as the prey, the one who has been caught in the snare, the one who has been trapped. Life really does have a way of shocking all of us like that. Like when I got a text from Donna Bixby this morning. And 1 minute she said, my dad had a heart attack. I tried to call her right away and couldn't get through. And a minute later she says, my dad is dead. Nobody expected that when they went to bed last night or when they got up this morning. Where did that come from? We often find ourselves asking. And to put an edge on this, in this context, I think we would do well to remember those specifics of what he just said we are able to enjoy by the grace of God. Your food and your drink. Someday you're enjoying it, and the next day you lose your job and you have no idea how you're going to put your food on the table the next week. Or maybe something happens to you physically, and although there's food there, you really don't have the capacity anymore to actually enjoy it. Or maybe somebody's having to feed you. Those enjoyments could disappear just like that. What about the celebration that is pictured by that white clothing? And you could be in the middle of a party and all of a sudden receive some shocking, some disturbing news that throws your whole life for a tailspin. And what about your companion or your spouse? And you have been enjoying life with the wife whom you love, and then all of a sudden, she's gone. Or what about your work? And you get laid off, or you somehow lose your ability to contribute, and you are laid up and can no longer be productive. What if in one of those areas of your life, things go south all of a sudden? That's what he wants you to be considering. He just came out of talking about those details, and he wants you to consider you could be ensnared all of a sudden. Everything just disappears out of nowhere. And your abilities are going to be unable to protect you from those kinds of circumstances. Now, you look at that, and it's jarring. It's one of these counterpoints. You just got this reality check after we were having such fun enjoying our lunch and our wives and everything else, and now he says this. How are we supposed to respond to that kind of scary point? You could give in to despair and just say, forget this. This is hopeless. This is crazy. Try to run away from it or something. You could just try to give up on serving God altogether and just give yourself over to a life of hedonism, since we're going to die anyway and anything could happen, then who really cares? Well, those are the kinds of overreactions that people are inclined toward when they really face those kinds of circumstances or have loved ones that face those kinds of circumstances. But I want to encourage you with the direction that Solomon is going to go with it here in just a moment. And I want to share with you an illustration by commentator Zach Eswine that I have found to be very helpful. Let me read this for you. He says, imagine a basketball team made up of 7 and 8-year-olds. One team cheats, trips, trash talks, and pushes. Imagine that the referees are friends of the cheating team's coaches. It becomes obvious that the referees are biased in favor of this cheating team. Now imagine that you coach the opposing team. What do you tell your players? You can tell them to quit. You can say, I hate this game. There is no point in trying because no matter what you do, you will not win. And you can get hurt in the process. Let's get out of here. Or you can tell them to return the same kind of behavior. You can say to your team, I hate this game. Since this is all unfair and no one seems to care, you do the same to them. You need to cheat, trip, trash talk, and push. If the only way to get ahead is to break the rules, so be it. So, isn't that how people tend to think? They face all these disappointments in life or react one way or the other. Well, this preacher in Ecclesiastes looks at both options. He fully understands what it means to hate how the game is being played. Life in a cursed world. You hate it in a real sense. But when he looks at walking away, this leaves folly to win on the court. Folly then becomes the only game in town. Likewise, when he looks at joining in and fighting folly with folly, this too leaves only folly on the court. Folly still remains the only game in town. If you take those approaches, folly's going to have the upper hand and be the only message out there. The preacher agrees on the one hand. I hate this life, he admits. But the response this kind of hatred promotes differs substantially from the other two ideas that I just described. And here's what he seems to say, the preacher. I will oppose the life I hate. I will oppose it, but I will do so with wisdom. That's going to be my response. That's going to be my strategy. It is not because I will necessarily win in this world. I likely will not win in this world. But at least wisdom will remain on the court. At least folly will no longer offer the only game in town. At least those who watch the game will have an alternative set in front of them, and those who play and get hurt will have a way of healing still available to them. And he puts it this way, this is a great little summary, in a sense of the whole book. It is as if the preacher says to us, hate life, join the wisdom resistance. And that brings us to his second thought here. The counterpoint to life's circumstances being so uncertain. In the rest of the passage, the point is, wisdom is still the best option for living life. Verses 13 to 18. Wisdom is still the best option for living life. And he illustrates the superiority of wisdom in verses 13 to 15 with this little story. I have also seen, there's that counterpoint language, we're kind of shifting topics all of a sudden, going a different direction. I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works. And it's interesting that that word siege works is from the same root as the word net back in verse 12. In other words, you're supposed to keep these two things connected. He's talking about some of these surprises that come along in life. Here was a case where there was a surprise, a capture by a powerful army. And what happened? There was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Now, this is probably not a parable. It almost sounds like, in keeping with all this other observation going on in this book, it almost sounds like this is a real story, that something that that Solomon observed or something that he heard about. And there are many examples of how this kind of thing has taken place historically. I kind of wonder if he's thinking of something that happened back in 2 Samuel chapter 20, where the city of Abel was besieged. And it wasn't a wise man, it was actually an otherwise unknown wise woman who said, look, these guys are after this one guy. Why don't we just kill this one guy and throw him over the wall and they'll leave us alone? That was her idea. And it worked. And the city was delivered. Something like that is what he has in mind. I appreciate that he is so realistic about the prospects for those kind of wise people in life. And here again, there's all this tension in this counterpoint, because he goes right along and says, yet no one remembered that poor man. Like, if I hadn't mentioned the story from 2 Samuel 20, maybe remember that story? I didn't remember it until I saw it in somebody's commentary using it as an example. Whoever heard of this lady? What was her name? Or what else did she do? Or what happened after that? Who knows? She's been sort of lost in the sands of time, and got these few verses there in 2 Samuel. And that, sadly, is the way it happens, even with wisdom. See, wisdom is not going to necessarily make you famous. It's not going to put you up on top of the world and make everybody love you and mean that you're going to be rich and recognized and honored the rest of your life. And not necessarily. He's very realistic in that the poor man was forgotten. That is so true to life. The results may not last. They may not be long-term. They may not be eternal. Especially as it relates to your own personal glory. It's not necessarily going to be attached to you, and people think wonderful thoughts about you. But that doesn't change the fact from the story that people's lives were saved. The population was not slaughtered. The city was not destroyed. It was delivered. Wisdom had considerable life-saving benefits, even though the individual may have been forgotten. And with that illustration, he goes on to declare something of the superiority of wisdom, that it is still the best option for living life. When he says in verse 16, but I say that wisdom is better than might. All right, so there's one comparison. It is better than might. Even though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. I mean, I don't know it's better than might. Well, who won the battle? Her wisdom delivered the city. And even if she was thought little of going forward, and even though people later on didn't pay attention to her very much, to him very much, nevertheless, she still won. He still won the victory. Wisdom is better than might. And verse 17, wisdom is also better than shouting. Verse 17, the words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. And also, verse 18, wisdom is better than weapons of war. But if somebody goes another route and gives himself over to a life of folly and sin and selfishness and rebellion, what's going to come out of that life is destruction. Wisdom is better than all these things that the world tends to view as kind of the key or a key or some keys to advancement in life. It is better than might. It is better than shouting. It is better than weapons. Now, isn't that so contrary to how a lot of people are thinking in our country this very moment? Whether it is those in power or those protesting the power, as to how we can push forward our agenda, whether it's right or wrong. What does the Bible say about what is most likely to get your plans to succeed? It is not might, it is not shouting, it is not upheaval and warfare, It is wisdom. And I want to say that this perspective here is counterculture to a whole slice of American way of thinking. This emphasis on independence and my rights and pushing my way forward and listen to me. God says, no, here is what is most likely to succeed. It is gracious, quiet, wise handling of circumstances and of people. Now, there would be many applications to what I've just introduced there. Here we are, just barely getting into this topic of the superiority of wisdom. He's not going to apply it very much, because actually that's what all of chapter 10 is about. Chapter 10 is going to be laying out for us a number of advantages of wisdom over folly and giving us some areas in life, particularly in terms of politics and our relationship with our leaders. Those areas are going to be under discussion here. The applications are actually still to come. But I don't want to wait entirely to give you some things to consider on a practical level. If we are convinced that life is uncertain and that anything can happen to throw off our plans despite our abilities, and that the way to respond to that is just to, guided by God's word and by God's spirit, strive to be as wise as possible with the opportunities that he has given us, okay? What does that look like? Well, let me just give you one area, because I bring this up because it's an area that we have just been considering in the other messages. And that is the whole area of our relationships. And included in that are marriages, which were the topic of the message last week. With all the emphasis here on relating to other people, companionship, communication, and so forth, I'm just going to read five Proverbs and not say anything much about them. And I bring this up as one application of how this passage should guide us in dealing with the tense and unexpected circumstances of life. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. The tongue of the wise commends knowledge, but the mouths of fools pours out folly. Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. Whoever covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates close friends. A fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. And I guess I actually have six verses. Here's one more. If one gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and shame. Now you just take those six verses, Proverbs 15:1, 15:2, 16:24, 17:9, 29:11, 18:13. And you ponder that for a while. I've been pondering them. And I can't guarantee that by my persuasion or my experience, all my relationships are going to go well and everybody's going to respond rightly and so forth. But I'm not going to help the situation by getting angry. That's only going to hurt it. By lashing out, by trashing people, by walking away from them. That's not going to help. Wisdom, even though it's not going to solve all the problems, it is still the best option for living life. Nothing is going to guarantee harmonious and pleasant relationships, but am I exacerbating the problems by my unedifying or by my unloving communication? Wisdom, even though it's not a guarantee, it is still the best option. What have we seen this morning? We have seen that life circumstances are uncertain, but wisdom is still the best option for living life. And I have emphasized there about our communication, but I don't want to stop there either, because I want to connect, as we close here, this whole theme of wisdom to the rest of the canon, and as I've often tried to do at the close of these messages, taking it onto a higher level. Not thinking only about the horizontal and the earthly, but how these truths about wisdom have their consummation in the Lord Jesus Christ. Do you realize that there actually is a kind of wisdom that is a guarantee? Because it's not wisdom just on a personal level about what's likely to help here in life. It is a God-ordained wisdom that he has put together to free me finally from all the vaporiness of life to start with. All of these burdens, there actually is an ultimate display of this wisdom and an ultimate resolution to these tensions. And his name is Jesus, and 1 Corinthians 1 calls Jesus Christ both the power of God and the wisdom of God. And there's so much about what has been said in this passage, it's so reflective of Christ. He's not unlike the poor, wise man who delivered the city. Not very impressive, forgotten by many people, countercultural, not working the way the world does, and yet he is the one through whom God wisely has worked to deliver us from our sin and from ultimately the curse of this world. And Paul goes on to say there in 1 Corinthians that what looks foolish to people, the so-called foolishness of God, ends up being wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And let me leave you with this last statement. As we are trusting in Christ as the wisdom of God to ultimately resolve these things, here's what Jesus said. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. He is our wisdom. He's the one who has wisely redeemed us to God, and the one who grows us in wisdom here on earth, that no matter what circumstances may come, enables us to persevere and be stable and be trusting and move forward as we await the consummation of the purposes of God.